All right. This is episode 62. Episode 62. Trevor and Matt versus Eleanor. 3, 2, 1.
All right. Good evening to you, ladies and gentlemen.
Trevor?
What?
Wait. Trevor? Lowrider. Lowrider, Trevor.
All right, let's ride.
Oh, my.
Good call.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store. And he promised to do anything he can to help me to get the text.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to pay.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
We got tired of anything that fits neatly into the pop culture zeitgeist, folks. We don't want any sensible references. We don't want anything that fits neatly into one place or time, or that has a plot that makes sense, or where any sort of reason reigns over the script. So we did what you do when you've got to do what you've got to do. And we started to watch a movie that starts with a lightning hitting a tree.
Good old Jerry Bruckheimer. You know you're in for a ride. Well, anyways, welcome to the Nighthawks podcast. I'm Trevor Trujillo. I'm one of your co-hosts here in the Nighthawks Cafe. And sitting across the booth from me
is the co-host with the moderate amountist. Matt Foster.
We decided that it was time to dip into our own pool of nostalgia and revisit a favorite from our more formative years. We just got off having talked about Ready Player One in our last episode, which is a movie that is just dripping with nostalgia. And we decided, you know, it's like, hey, the 80s are cool. And if you're watching the movie, there's more than just the 80s, which is kind of one of the problems. But you know, we got a little nostalgic ourselves, so we decided to revisit one of our old favorites from when we were just coming into our 20s.
Basically, we decided to watch the best movie of all time. It is a little treasure from the vault, a little, I really think it epitomizes everything that celluloid was invented to convey. We watched something called Gone in 60 Seconds.
Yes, the year 2000 offering from director Dominic Sena.
Yeah, not the conventionally accepted as good one with Michael Caine. No,
that wasn't Michael Caine. You're thinking of something else. Actually, yeah, Gone in 60 Seconds, the Nicolas Cage, probably the more well-known 2000 remake, is a remake of a film that I'm going to confess to you, Matt, I have never actually seen, the OG Gone in 60 Seconds. Made in 1974, directed, starring, written by, and produced by H.B. Halicki. It's a movie about an insurance adjuster who owns a chop shop on the side and runs a auto theft ring and gets a pretty incredible opportunity to make some big money for one huge heist of 48 cars. Things go, in particular Hollywood fashion, things go wrong, they encounter problems. It's It's basically, if you were to take the concepts behind the 1960s Ocean's 11, where you have an ensemble heist film, and mix it in with something on the line with Vanishing Point, and really give it that kind of look and feel in that era of the 70s. The 2000 remake...
Let me lay this one out. The modern, air quotes, since it's pushing 20.
Yeah, it's coming up on 20 years old now.
you go to hell. We're young and pretty. But the 2000 Gone in 60 Seconds is a story about a crime family, but not really a crime family. It's not like a deep mob thing. I consider it sort of a alternate universe, Fast and Furious sort of family of choice thing. What happens is a car theft ring is busted up at an inopportune time. The character Kip Raines, played by Giovanni Ribisi, is kind of left holding the bag on 50 cars that he owns a mobster. 50 specific cars. Now, this isn't your trash car thief that takes Celicas so that the fenders can be removed and stolen. This is somebody stealing specific, beautiful, classic, or high-value cars for, like, some Arab sheikh somewhere. And so
I believe it is actually a South American or Central American crime lord that they dropped.
Yeah, yeah. So it's 50 specific cars that have to be stolen intact, old school, heist style, the way Archer would do it. And he has only 4 days to deliver all 50 cars. Kip's mentor, he goes and he dusts off Kip's older brother, played by, what did you call him, Trevor? A national treasure?
Yes, the one, the only, the legendary Nicolas Cage.
Cinematic poet laureate, Nicolas Cage.
One who has seen both the darkness and the lightness of coffee. And depending on how much of it he's had will depend on what kind of performance you're going to get out of the guy.
A man who is somewhat famous despite being essentially a living drug hallucination who looks somewhat like an adult Beavis. We don't know if he's good looking or bad looking. We don't know if he's rich or poor. We don't know if he's good or evil. All we know is that when there's sweet, juicy scenery to be devoured, if you want someone to shake, if you can't get Michael Shannon and you need someone to just grip the scenery in his teeth and shake it like a terrier killing a rat, you get in a cage. And he is just soared so close, and then the wax melts from his feathers, and his next one will be so, so wrong.
Yeah, he plays Memphis Raines in this movie, an old-time car thief who has since retired. And when he gets word that his brother is in trouble, this master car thief with a heart of gold comes to his rescue. It's up to Memphis to kind of assemble the motley crew back together for one last big score. They have to get 50 cars in just a matter of hours. And the prize at the end of it is going to be $200,000 and, of course, the life of his brother. I had this a little further down the list to talk about, but I think I'm going to go ahead and just, like, hop on this now. As I was sitting down, and I have only watched this movie maybe a handful of times. I saw it when it came out theatrically, and then maybe once or twice on DVD. I've always enjoyed it. I've always liked it. I always have a good time watching it. But I can't shake the fact that this is not a good film. This is not a good movie. So I kind of asked myself as I was watching through this time, why does this work for me? And that's kind of what I hoped to bring to the podcast today.
You are right. It is the opposite of a good movie. It is a great movie.
And that is an important distinction. Like, the enjoyment I get out of this film is not ironic. It's not maybe on the way you would expect somebody to enjoy a Manos Hands of Fate or even, I don't know, something a little more
contemporary.
The Room. It's not that kind of movie. I get a genuine, sincere feeling of enjoyment when I watch this movie.
That's where I'm going to let you finish, but let me stop you. You're wrong that it's not a good movie. It's not a realistic movie.
Okay, I'll give you that.
It's just an anime with actors in it. It's a Japanese drift anime with humans in it. That's
okay. I'll give that to you.
It doesn't make out exterior sense, but it plays by its rules. And everybody in it is just such an eye-popping sort of conundrum. Let's call it the opposite of the oft-mentioned Ishtar factor. We're going to call it the Conan factor. Or wait, let's call it the De Laurentiis factor.
The De Laurentiis factor, okay.
Just a movie so massively up its own ass that it emerges through the wormhole and conquers. Just
time it took you to buy your ticket. 3.2 minutes. Time it took you to get your popcorn. 2.5 minutes. Time it took them.
Well, let's go.
To steal your car.
Hello, ladies.
60 seconds.
Move, go.
Come on, sweet baby, work your magic.
Hold on, I know you ain't gonna do what I think you'll do.
To go old school. A day to shop, a day to prep.
Surprise attack.
Nice. Little trick I learned in the car thief retirement home.
By the time the first car's reported stolen, your ship set sail. We do this, we do it my way.
I was just a sucker for a redhead.
You break it, you buy it, my friend.
I think one of the things I really enjoy, number one, I'm a sucker for a heist movie, especially ensemble heist movies. Give me like an Ocean's 11 or even an Ocean's 13. Wasn't as warm on Ocean's 12, but that's a topic for a different show. You know, or even like the old school Frank Sinatra Ocean's 11. And then, you know, you look at stuff that maybe isn't necessarily heist oriented, but has a good ensemble mischief value to it. I'm thinking off the top of my head, something like Toy Soldiers.
Mind Games with Patrick Stewart.
Masterminds was the name of that one. And
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was
yeah,
not
yeah.
especially a fan of that one. That was a little too one.
What?
That movie was actually so bad that when Ebert and Roper did it for their year-end roundup, they had actually forgotten that they had seen the movie and had to be reminded what it was about.
Well, that's just snobbery on their part.
But, man, as far as ensemble heist crimes go, this one really just can't be beat, and I think it's due in large part to the actors that we've got present here. Not all of whom were named or recognizable at the time. Some of them were legendary at the time. But, man, this is just a really slick ensemble. They crackle well off each other. It looks good. It works good. And it's really fun to kind of see some of these careers in their nascency.
I have a nutty ensemble here who, like Cage had heat at the time. I believe he'd... Wasn't he pretty close in time to when he did the, speaking of remakes with Cage in him, the Kiss of Death remake?
That was about 3 or 4 years before. That was in 1995.
It's all blurring together for me.
Oh, yeah, but it was him and David Caruso and Stanley Tucci, Helen Hunt, Samuel L. Jackson. That was a good one, too. And I'm actually kind of glad that you brought up Fast and the Furious. Fast and the Furious, the first The Fast and the Furious, I guess we need to differentiate there. The first edition of that franchise with Paul Walker and Vin Diesel would come out a year later. And this kind of predated that, but has a lot of DNA with The Fast and the Furious. And I think that even though The Fast and the Furious has gone on to become its own gonzo thing, where if you were to watch fresh without any preconceptions the first movie and then the latest movie, they don't even seem like the same franchise. I think, though, that Gone in 60 Seconds actually achieves what The Fast and the Furious was going for a little bit better than the original Fast and the Furious.
I've honestly gotten to the point where I will also unironically defend the current state of the Fast and the Furious franchise.
You know, I am, too. It took me a long, long time to come around on that franchise. But round about the fourth movie is when I, like, hey, this is turning into something that I kind of like. But it's the same concept, where it's not a realistic movie. It's not a movie that is necessarily even artistically sound. but they do have an artistry and a funness and a sincere enjoyment to be had out of just how over the top they are.
It's the MDMA of action movies. too much will eat a hole in your brain eventually, but a little bit's fun, and we're going to do it now. The litany that we had Cage coming off of, like, this was hot functional Cage. This is maybe his longest good study run. You had Kiss of Death, Leaving Las Vegas, The Rock, Con Air, Face Off, City of Angels, Snake Eyes, 8mm, Bringing Out the Dead, and then Gone in 60 Seconds. And then immediately after that, he did Captain Corelli's Mandolin, Wind Talkers, and Adaption. So Matchstick Men, and then the first National Treasure. It was before he hit, like, he did Lord of War, Weatherman, and Wicker Man, and then he did Ghost Rider, which infamously blew up in his face.
Well, and Wicker Man wasn't that solid either. That actually brings me to an important point. I have a couple of Nick Cage scales that I want us to see where we would put this. The first Nick Cage scale I want to talk about is the actual Nick Cage scale. Where does this fall on the Nick Cage scale? And by that I mean we have two houses of Nick Cage. We've got Nick Cage the auteur and Nick Cage the maniac. And I'm stealing that designation from the actual Caged Marathon that they host in Austin, Texas. That is the Greg McLennan duality of Nicolas Cage. So if we have on a scale of auteur where you would have, say, Adaptation, to Maniac where you have Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, both of them great films, both of them films I enjoyed immensely watching, but definitely two different sides of the Nicolas Cage coin. Matt, where would you put Gone in 60 Seconds?
If I must step out upon that, the ground of that duality, I'd say dead in the middle. I happen to think there is also a Nicolas Cage action comic. He's the guy we saw in Raising Arizona.
Okay.
Arguably the guy we saw in Bringing Out the Dead and Ghost Rider. And obviously some of the later, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, for example, the not Harry Dresden movie. Oh, I forgot he was in The Frozen Ground. They were just talking about that in the last podcast on the left. It's an extremely disturbing actual story, but a terrible movie about it. That somehow they put Cage and Cusack in it. Oh, Vanessa Hudgens is the hooker with a heart of gold in it. I think just this real lame adaptation of this real life serial killer story. Horrible real story about a guy that hunted people for sport in Alaska.
Yeah.
But yeah, real piece of work there.
Okay, so I would concede you that it probably falls right on the middle. This is not a Nicolas Cage really chewing scenery. He leaves that for Christopher Eccleston in this one. But he's also not sedate and artistic. You know, this is a very good middle of the road, good sell at the box office, Nicolas Cage.
This was a moment. This was a snapshot in time when the industry was deciding if it was going to have more 80s, 90s style Arnold, Rambo, Schwarzenegger style implausible action heroes, and deciding at the same time if Cage would be one of them. So it's this point in his career, like this, maybe Con Air too, like where they were deciding, like, is this guy going to carry action movies? And they tried a few. I think they're great. Like, I love this. I love Con Air, man. Like, there's just that, and that bad Southern accent, man. How could I look my wife and daughter in the eye if I left that woman there to be dishonored and die? Like, it's not a good line, but it's a great line because he delivers it with complete faith in what he's doing. Just like the De Laurentiis factor, like Conan. Like, just, Crom, I do not pray to you often. Like, it's that kind of, the whole movie's like that. except he's praying not to an ancient god of battle, but to a silver car.
Yeah. So now there's another Nick Cage scale here that I want to parse. We're calling it the Nick Cage quality scale. Now, this is relative to Nick Cage films. How quality is this movie as art, as entertainment, however you reckon it? And again, we're going to start on a scale of, say, high art like Rumblefish to schlocky crap like the Wicker Man remake theatrical cut. Where would you put it there?
In the Cage oeuvre. when you're punching up against the Weatherman and Adaption, you're definitely not going to get that 10 spot away from Adaption, I don't think.
Right.
So.
Well, and I'm a pretty big booster for Matchstick Men, too. I mean, we're going to have a probably pretty robust if-then section here, so we'll stow it for most of that. But, so where on the scale would you throw it, then?
I'd say if it's an art scale, we're again in the middle. This is a very competent movie. I actually, on this rewatch, I noticed some photographic things that I didn't notice before where I think this is worth watching just as a visual fiction. It's a beautiful treatment of like sort of the industrial, gritty, slummy part of L.A. And it just like it uses the smog to great yellowing effect and everything. Like the way I described it to the friend I was watching it with, hi, Nick, if you're out there.
Hey, Nick.
This is a movie that David Fincher could have made if he was just having a good time while he made it. instead of dragging himself through like the Daniel Day-Lewis space.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good middle of the road one. I mean, you're not going to come away with this with any kind of big social commentary. You're not going to come away with some grander message. There's not much being said here other than let's put some beautiful people in some really nice cars and do the things that people who drive cars like that want to do with them. They want to do them because they see movies like this. As a matter of fact, I was actually working in the movie theater when this film came out, back at the turn of the millennium. And this is one of those movies, much like The Fast and the Furious, where we did notice a suspiciously high number of cars getting pulled over after screenings of the film. I'm not going to say that the police were camped out there waiting for people to come out of the movie and do something stupid, but I'm not saying it either.
For me, what I learned not to do is, speaking of things that came out around the turn of the century, I learned hard lessons about driving immediately after playing Need for Speed.
You know, the game that did that to me was the original Driver on PS1, which was actually, it was a great game for the time. It was what would later inform the GTA 3 and Beyond series. Once you sit down in a game store and play that for 6 hours and then go home, that drive home is a long, slow, arduous slog.
You played that for 6 hours at a time in a game store?
Yeah, I think you were there.
Did Dave Chappelle come up to you and go, you know, we sell this, right?
And you know what? I bought it there, too, eventually.
Oh, all right, all right. Yeah.
Shane, if you're
All's
listening,
forgiven.
Yeah, thank you.
All's forgiven. Shout out to old school Casper Digital Dreams / The Grid. That was good times back when.
# gone but not forgotten. So Nick Cage, yeah, national treasure. I'm an unironic fan. He works for me in this. He's one of those guys that we've talked about this with like Keanu Reeves before, where it's like the guy has a good performance in him. And I will say probably Nicolas Cage might even be the stronger actor than Keanu Reeves, although I'd hate to put them up against each other like that.
There's only one way to find out. John Wicker Man. You killed his dog. Now he's going to unleash the bees.
Oh, you're running my train of thought. I think that Nicolas Cage is one of those actors that you can get a great performance out of if the filmmaker behind the camera knows what the hell they're doing. I think that there was a good performance in Nicolas Cage from Wicker Man, but the rest of the movie did not support the performance he was giving, and it seemed like they weren't willing to kind of rein Nicolas Cage into the movie they were making. But in other cases, you watch Adaptation or Matchstick Men or, you know, something along those lines where he's really, really, really good. And now that I'm done f***ing Nick Cage's I'm going to f*** Angelina Jolie's and, you know, like I said, it's been a few years since I've seen this movie. Angelina Jolie, this was right about the time where she really hit big. She wasn't Lara Croft Tomb Raider yet, but she was about to be. And she's this really kind of grungy, but very chic, very sexy figure. And what I like about her in this movie, now this is a movie made of its time, it's not perfect. I don't think it passes the Bechdel test, but Angelina Jolie, for as much as she could have been a cheesecake in this, I think they treated her rather well. She was competent, she was sexy, she was sex positive, but with a dialed down cheesecake on it, so it didn't come off as feeling grungy.
She occupies a place in the dynamic, right? we have to get into a little bit more of the rhythm of this movie, right? Honestly, this movie is a record. It's not a movie. Like, what happens in this movie is during the credits, the needle is dropped on a song, and the rest of the movie continues on pace like that. So this movie actually literally almost hits a beat and keeps the beat. We have a credit sequence. It's like this very lean exposition where we alternate between, you know, kind of some CGI of gears and car parts and racing memorabilia, and then it alternates with family photos. We're introduced to the idea that the Raines' father is some kind of missing automotive industry, like a race car driver or some other kind of, you know, and he's gone now. And then we have the older brother and the younger brother, and they're in implied competition. And then as the movie unfolds, we found out that Memphis has retired in the hopes that Kip won't take after him. Kip takes after him anyway because all he ever wanted to be was like his older brother. Kip's crew is in trouble, and they need Memphis's old crew to bail them out. It was an attempt to make a movie for everybody, right? So you have Scott Kahn, Giovanni Ribisi, you have this younger crew. They're juxtaposed against these older guys, and what the whole movie reminds me of the part in Reservoir Dogs where Tim Roth's Mr. Orange, he tells his associates about the idea that the guy running the show is just, he's just cool. He's just this cool older guy. He's full of cool stories. He's full of cool anecdotes. You wanna just sit back and listen to the rhythm as he talks. So this whole thing's a record, and these older guys are kind of the underlying beat. And the younger guys are kind of the melody, right? And so you have, you know, Delroy Lindo. You have Robert Duvall, who some of you may remember from Secondhand Lions and some other stuff he was in once upon a time. Not a very big actor, but he's been in a few things, right? Before and after this. You have Vinnie Jones, who's the Silent Hulk character. You may remember him as a heavy in many of the Guy Ritchie London mob movies. He's a barely, almost mute character, like a vicious Silent Bob in this. He's juxtaposed against the young urban fella who talks too much. You know, that guy right out of Central Casting.
I don't know. See, I really liked that character, and I didn't mind his interpretation of it, but it is a little Chris Tucker-ish. You know, it is the edgy urban loudmouth. I'm not sure if that a characterization you can get away with anymore?
Ludacris keeps getting away with it in Fast and Furious movies.
Yes, hey, I'll shut up.
So does Tyrese in Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah.
I'm getting somewhere with this. I really am. So you have these two groups of men, right? And what happens is they sort of naturally partner off with their logical equivalent in the other crew. There's a heavy in the crew. There's a gear guy in the crew. Well, she does two things. She's in the middle of the age range. Like if you took the very youngest guy on Kip's crew and Duvall is the oldest guy on the other crew, right? She steps in chronologically. She is as Memphis's ex. She's the age bridge between them. She's like the messenger, where she's like the cool, you know, like the cool older chick to the young guys, and she's like the off limits kind of ingenue to the very oldest, to Delroy Lindo and Duvall, wandering this cut through the middle of the generation gap in the film. And she's also the other, as they sort of pair off into buddy duos, she's also the only one with no real counterpart. She's sort of a valence electron, moves information around in the movie, right?
Deep nerd.
And the extra little bit of kinesis that she brings to it, she's like the one girl in a Western. She makes everybody kind of like straighten up and push their chairs in and display some display some posture and manners when she's on deck. And it's a very electric effect she has on the whole cast, because they're all kind of trying to use their peripherals when she's around, you know. She is definitely important to the chemistry of the movie, but she's also somewhat unavailable.
Right, and what I liked about that is they kind of indicate that by she is sexy, but she is not overly sexualized. And when she is in a scene where that sexualization comes into play, she's in charge. She's driving. She's accepting of it. She shuts it down, and the guy says, okay, she shut it down. It's business time, which is a shockingly mature take on an exchange like that. Especially in a movie coming out from the turn of the millennium.
What do you think is more exciting, having sex or stealing cars?
Having sex or losing cars. Well, how about having sex while boosting cars.
Yeah, that's a good line. Ooh. Doesn't work on a lot of girls, though.
I just blurted it out. I'm But you haven't answered the question.
Well, you see, the problem is, how do you get over the shifter?
Oh, right, because the,
Because it gets in the way.
Because you wouldn't want to disrupt the, synchro mesh, right? Or the throttle linkage. Mm-hmm. Clutch master cylinder. Overhead camshaft.
I can't do this.
Just straight inline six. Triple Weber carburetors. Bolted to each other's body structures.
Well, it's time to work.
Good brakes. Good brakes, too.
For one thing, she was refreshingly bereft of the current boyfriend. Like, the element of, like, in many movies that follow this basic outline, she would have to be won back. What makes her character slightly different is she's the one that stayed in the life. And that makes a key difference, because she's just like, no, I'm not going to go run a gas station. I'm good at this.
Well, and what I liked is there was also no big reveal. There was no, she takes a racing helmet off, shakes out her hair, and oh my God, it's a girl. And there's no yard sticking either. There's no, oh, she's a good car thief for a girl asterisk. She's an equal member of the party. She's actually an elevated member of this party. There's no explanation given. She is a girl, and she is also good at this, and they leave it at that, which is, again, refreshing for a movie of this time. You know, you even look forward a year to Fast and the Furious, where the female characters are relegated to either partner or sister status, you know. I also do want to mention the one piece of casting that just didn't quite click for me, and I got really excited when I saw him. I had forgotten he was in this movie, and I probably, the last time I watched this movie, barely had a grasp on who he was at the time. It just goes to show how long it's been since I've revisited. But Timothy Oliphant shows up in this. We've talked about him a few times on the show, probably best known from his turn on Justified as Raylan Givens, opposite to Walton Goggins. And he's another dude who has just made some really fantastic work. He's currently doing Santa Clarita Diet for Netflix.
I gotta stop the train for a minute. I hate the acquired taste argument, right? Santa Clarita Diet Season 1 is a little disjointed. Season 2 is a genuine delight, and Oliphant is great in it and very very different than he is in Justified.
Yes, and that actually ties into what I'm about to say, because in this, he's playing a lawman. He's playing the partner to Delroy Lindo's kind of no-nonsense aged partner. And it would have been easy for him to be just a prototype of Raylan Givens, or a prototype of several other roles he's played where he's the no-nonsense lawman. Deadwood, another fine example. He's actually kind of an aw-shucks, doofy kind of, and I don't know if he just didn't necessarily pull it off, or if he didn't necessarily do it with that signature Oliphant flair that wouldn't come until later. But he was probably the weakest link as far as the cast goes here, and I think it's just because they didn't give him a ton to work with. But it is kind of an interesting prototypical Timothy Oliphant role that he would later then go on to make his own.
I think actually the reason the chemistry didn't quite work is the opposite. I think he was supposed to be kind of like Duffy in Boondock Saints.
Uh-huh.
Like he was supposed to be a little a real foil for Delroy Lindo. Instead, you got he was a little too operant in it, and he didn't come off. It was very, the moments where he kind of puts his foot in his mouth don't jibe well with the moments where he's actually kind of action guy, you know. But he does manage to provide some comic relief. You okay? You sure? Because you just went through a wall.
Yeah. Just, you know, since we're talking about the cast, there's a lot of weird kind of post Gone in 60 Seconds crossover for a lot of these players. For example, we're talking about Delroy Lindo and Timothy Oliphant. They would appear together in A Life Less Ordinary.
Which is bomb.
Timothy Oliphant and Delroy Lindo would appear in adaptations of Elmore Leonard books, Oliphant being in Justified and Lindo in Get Shorty from a few years previous to this. Scott Kahn and Giovanni Ribisi would appear this same year in Boiler Room together with one of Vin Diesel, speaking of Fast and the Furious. You've also got Bodie Elfman, who was also a producer on Jerry Bruckheimer's Armageddon and was a producer with Jerry Bruckheimer on Enemy of the State. Nicolas Cage and Michael Pena, keep your eyes peeled. Early role of Michael Pena in Gone in 60 Seconds. Blink and you'll miss it, but he's there. They would go on to star in World Trade Center together. Nicolas Cage would also appear with Scott Kahn's father in Honeymoon in Vegas. That was back in 92. Scott Kahn and Barry Pepper appeared in Enemy of the State, and Giovanni Ribisi appeared with Pepper in Saving Private Ryan. So there's a lot of intermingling of this particular group of actors, really showing that I think as much as we want to give this movie credit, this is definitely a studio film to please audiences. This was made to make money. This was made to be a blockbuster. This was made to be a big deal action popcorn film. And I think on that level, it very much succeeds.
That's what's awesome here is how there's a certain sort of brainlessness that is becomes self-awareness. This just knows what it's doing and executes.
Well, and I think you brought this up while we were watching the film, and actually you came out and called the trope, and you were absolutely right, where you noticed that the first time we're introduced to Nicolas Cage, who is this retired car thief, he is giving this, I don't know, this motivational speech like a coach would before the game, and he's talking about, you know, you need to learn how to drive, and you need to be one with the car, and that is when you will truly drive fast, this, that, and the other. And we pull out, and he's talking to a group of kids at a go-kart track. You called it a cat save, and you're right. If you're going by the parlance of our times, the Save the Cat book, a handy screenwriting guide to how to make a marketable film, it's a good move. Because already, if he's a car thief, that makes him, in the mindset of the audience, probably a villain. He's a bad guy. He takes things that aren't his. And so we need to endear this audience to our main character in order for this to work. And we do it in spades in this movie, almost to the point where it almost doesn't work that he was at one time a bad guy. It's referenced again in the film later on when he's talking with the Angelina Jolie character. And they're kind of discussing his life of crime before he retired. And he talks about how he never did it for the money. He was never in it for the money. He was always in it for the heist, the thrill of the hunt. So that, again, makes his actions less selfish, kind of paints him as like a misunderstood auteur of sorts. And so there's a lot of that in here where we're making a movie to factory spec based on the factory rules because that's what's going to work for the biggest audience. And I think they did it here. I think this works for a lot of audiences.
He's a true anti-hero where he's mostly hero, where you're like, with one little nudge, this guy could have been a heroic cop or a heroic race car driver or a heroic something, something, something. But instead, he decided to steal mostly from rich people. Cars that were mostly insured, you know?
Yeah.
And so we're kind of given the softest version of this, and then we're showed he sort of sees his own negative potential in his brother. And so he's like, no, you're not the Robin Hood I was. You're the thing I was trying not to be, and you don't seem to quite get that, so let's...
Well, and it's important to say it's also the thing he didn't want his brother to be either. And that is a turning point and a point of conflict between the two brothers, probably the flimsiest one, the one that could have been solved with just a brief conversation. But there, you basically find out about mid-movie that the reason that Nick Cage retired is that, and you touched on it earlier, is that he did not want to prove to be a bad example to his little brother. And even though he was doing the car theft for the right reasons and for the right calls and against the right targets, it was still an enticing life that he did not want to coax his brother into, so he gave it all up. Well, that's also a point of contention because he gave up this life that he loved, this life that he wanted, this thing he was good at, to keep his brother out of it, and his brother got into it anyway. And so there's a little animosity there and a little conflict there. It's not overly dwelt on, but it's enough that it gives this some stakes.
Well, and it's even almost like you tried too hard and your absence accidentally created the necessary economic and parenting vacuum for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like almost like you tried so hard to keep him safe, you made him you helicoptered him, you made him overindulged, and he went the wrong way anyway. We have to discuss the person to whom they're delivering these cars, one Raymond Calitri.
Christopher Eccleston.
I think just perfect acting, nothing wrong at all. I like Christopher Eccleston, so please grain of salt the shade / tea about to vomit forth. But a little overwrought, I think. He is Raymond the Carpenter Calitri, a Finnish carpentry obsessed sort of lethal Ron Swanson type with a heavy British accent. That's sort of his gimmick is that he'll make your coffin before he puts you in it. He's all the time like sanding on some wood and talking about wood, relating wood to metal as he does carpentry in the back of his chop shop. Honestly, on the scale of all mob villains ever committed to celluloid, he is not that cheesy, but he's pretty over the top.
And I'll even say, if you look at this era, if you look at Romeo Must Die and Mission Impossible 2 and things like that, he's not even the most overwrought villain. There is an apocryphal story. Once again, this is coming from the IMDb trivia page, which is user-submitted, so take it for what it's worth. We'll call it urban legend. But Christopher Eccleston was not a big fan of his performance in this movie. He described it as, quote, a terrible film in which I give a terrible performance, end quote. Apparently, he was often recognized for Gone in 60 Seconds before he would go on to other high-profile projects. He'd say that people would come up to say, you were gone in 60 Seconds, mate. You were sh**. And he says, I had to have a laugh at that because I was. This is not the strongest Christopher Eccleston performance, but I think for as over-the-top as the car stunts are, for as over-the-top as the physics are in this movie, I think it works. I think it's like Udo Kier in Johnny Mnemonic.
That's the thing, is even though he's a little nutty, he doesn't break the rules of the setting.
No, uh-uh. It works.
This is set in some sort of Twilight, kind of the... like the world of darkness, where it's just like reality, but smudgier, you know. So this is set in a sort of parallel world where this guy exists. But and I love his banter in like the final action sequence when he pulls a gun on a cop and the cop says, you don't want to do this. He's, yeah, I do. I do. He's like, you pull that trigger, your life will be over. He's like, no, I pull this trigger, your life will be over. That's how guns work. But he was a hoot, but Sphinx and his sidekick could be I would love to see like those two guys do Vinnie Jones and what's the younger kid's name?
TJ Cross as Mirror Man.
I would love to see the two of them in a remake of Perfect Strangers. And to be fair, Vinnie Jones's default setting is total contempt, but his non-verbally expressed total contempt for this person he's been saddled with and then gradually warms up to is the stuff of legend. It reminded me of like a really car theft oriented episode of ALF.
I do have to say, the moment where I think TJ Cross shines, and this has stayed with me. I mean, this is not something that I rediscovered on this rewatch. When you mention Gone in 60 Seconds to me, the scene that pops in my head is when TJ Cross's character is standing at the impound lot in Beverly Hills, and he's trying to keep the attendant's attention. And so he's dressed in a really loud costume. He's just, you know, vamping for time. He's having a hard time doing it. And at
he's
one
doing,
point,
he's doing Cat Williams is what
he's
doing.
Yeah,
I realize.
He really is.
Wake up, man. Check this out. Every time I drive my Volvo at Beverly Hills, they tow this.
We ain't got any Volvos here.
There is a Volvo here. I know. They told me.
Wait. What I'm trying to tell you is there ain't no Volvos here.
Then get in your book, do something, find my damn Volvo. It's got to be somewhere in there. Check it out, man.
Wait. It's not nothing here. There's nothing here. Look. So, look, there's another one back here.
Hey, Hey, I tell you what, look at this. Look at it. Look at that. She's a bridge.
And, like, at one point, even just kind of devolves into him using a Barbie doll to do kind of a little salacious dance. And that's what I think I like about heist movies is, like, the one scene where a guy has to go in costume, incognito, impromptu, and get the situation settled by the skin of his teeth. Those are moments I love because they can be played for suspense, they can be played for comedy, and often can be both.
It's a comic book world. Like, it's a fiction where these things are possible. That's what separates it from something that's trying to be gritty.
Now, Matt, we're coming to the end of the episode here, but I did want to kind of touch off on this. I am not especially a gearhead. I'm not into automotive. I'm not into racing. Is that something that you're into? Is that a world you've ever tipped your toe into?
You know, I'm not tremendously so. We do have to talk about the sixth man in this movie. That's a sports reference, Trevor.
Oh, okay.
It's when the sixth man on the court is the whatever invisible force empowers a basketball team.
Yeah, I think they made a movie about that where it was a guardian angel.
Yeah, or a ghost or something. The cars. All the cars that they show are great, including the cars they drive before they start stealing more. So if you are a gearhead, there's a lot of cars flashed in this, although they don't really delve terribly deep into the history of the cars or their plants. And there's some good actor doing a stunt on the part of Cage in this, who likes to do as much of his own stunts as possible and loves cars. So he was reportedly he had to be kicked out of the car for some of the dangerous ones in this. The last car, the proverbial unicorn, is the car they call Eleanor. It is a Shelby GT500
Mustang,
one of the most alarming Ford Mustangs you could buy, and also one of the more, I'm going to say, tasteful, like one of the more restrained. Like it's not a Hello Officer red. It's this sort of chrome, low slung, like an adult would own. They are fast in real life, and they are pretty in real life. And I hope the one they wrecked was fiberglass.
You know, I do remember that. It is a distinct memory I have of watching this the first time. And it's why I brought up whether or not we were gearheads, because there is a little bit of automotive porn here for somebody who's keys into that particular oeuvre. I think this actually kicked off a lot of interest in that realm. In the scenes where the Shelby is destroyed, there was audible gasps heard in the audience. And I think I squirmed a little. I'm like, oh, man, I just... in 5 minutes, really fell in love with that car, and then now I'm watching it get crunched, you know?
The deal Cage makes with Kalitri is the cars have to be delivered on time. They get away with 49 cars, and the cops get him when he's stealing the last one, and he has to go on a long car chase. And he's supposed to have the car there at 8. He arrives at 8:07, and Kalitri crushes the car in front of him. Junkyard that is their cover business. You just die a little. Before we conclude, I have to give a shout-out to one beat in this movie I love that made an impression on me forever, is when the young kid steals a car that he found running.
Yeah, which is actually, that's a throwback to the original. But at one point, one of the kids who is really out to, like, prove himself, he wants to show the team that he's a go-getter and he's smart and he can do this too, grabs a car that is not on the list just as a crime of opportunity, and they get it back to the place and it is full of heroin, as it was, you know, used as a dead drop.
And then they ask him, like, did you stop to think who would leave their car running in an alley in Chinatown? Yeah. And forever for me, that set like a high bar for badness. Like, if you're really bad, you can just leave your stuff unlocked.
Yeah.
Actually, no, that scene where they're all kind of bonding over the car while they get rid of the heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it reminds me of what I think is a recurrent theme in action cop heist dramas. Cops and robbers come from the same social class.
Yeah.
That's always intrigued me. And, like, especially like you had your Infernal Affairs. I don't know if our audience doesn't know Infernal Affairs. It might be, didn't they do like an English remake of that? What are they? They got some bunch of half-assers to, I think there was a Dropkick Murphys song in it.
Oh, you mean The Departed?
I think, I think that's what they called it. Little crumb bum, another low budget, unnecessary English remake of a great foreign film.
Yeah, because Infernal Affairs was originally a Hong Kong movie. It was out of China.
Yeah, it's sort of the same plot, except the Irish mob, it's the local mafiosos, and they, they do the same thing where they take somebody all the way through college and police academy and turns out to be a plant. And
well, I'll tell you what, while we're on this thread, we've peppered a few if-then recommendations throughout the episode here, but do you want to just kind of consolidate them and give people kind of a sense of what those recommendations would be in toto?
I'll throw one big one and then you can go.
Okay.
I'm going to say if you like this, you should check out The Italian Job, which is arguably a better movie and at least as much fun, which was Wahlberg, I want to say Theron.
Oh, okay. So you're going Italian Job remake to go with our Gone in 60 Seconds remake.
Earlier, I alluded to the original with Michael Caine.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reference to the original, The Italian Job.
Uh-huh.
Now, we can choose to believe that I slipped up, or we can choose to believe that I was making an elaborate reference. I'll leave that up to the audience.
A good bookend reference, yeah. Some of the things I'm going to recommend, obviously, other ensemble heist movies like Ocean's 11 would fit right in there. Probably The Fast and the Furious, which starts as an illegal street racing, and kind of goes on to become heist and then espionage, and now I think they've just gone full A-team. So certain entries in that, and that's something maybe we'll have to parse for an episode, but basically if you hop on the first one and then skip to the fourth one, I think that'd be probably a good way to do that and just kind of...
Wait, are you telling people to skip Tokyo Drift?
Yeah. See, a good one would be Vanishing Point, which is an old 70s movie. This one I would skip the remake on. They did a remake of Vanishing Point with Viggo Mortensen and Jason Priestley, of all people. Not as good as the original. The original is actually kind of, in as much as it's a good car chase, gearhead porn movie that culminates in a race between two classic muscle cars, it's also this kind of pensive examination on the progression of the 60s into the 70s, not unlike Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Stars Cleavon Little as Super Soul, the enigmatic DJ who guides the outlaw Kowalski, played by Barry Newman, as he goes on a high-speed chase across the country. Really fantastic film. Definitely worth checking out. Also, I'm going to throw out a little love to another just super over-the-top comic book four-color cage exploitation film, and I'm going to throw out some love for Drive Angry. It has a little more cheesecake in it, and that's unfortunate, but it also has William Fichtner in it, which is amazing. He is definitely the plum role in Drive Angry, and it's just another over-the-top, literally ends with Nicolas Cage drinking from the skulls of his enemies. Just another really balls-to-the-wall popcorn watch that I think is criminally underappreciated. And it also involves Nicolas Cage in Fast Cars. So, I mean, where do you go wrong?
If we're going there, we might as well throw Ghost Rider under the bus.
I was not a big fan of the Ghost Riders. I don't know.
I think the second one's better than the first one. They're both kind of like, I remember just kind of smelling toast for 2 hours. I'm going to throw out the King of the Mall, if you're into this kind of thing. Little flick we call Bullet.
Steve McQueen classic.
It contains basically the prototypical car chase from which most other American car chases would spring for some time to come, through sort of the ripply streets of San Francisco. Mustang versus a Charger, classic of low-key bad guyery. Dude driving fast, trying to get out of trouble, you know. The log line is the script, so it's not like it's, you know.
All right, well, Matt, any final thoughts on Gone in 60 Seconds, the 2000 remake starring Nicolas Cage?
I don't know. I can't tell a person to go out and purchase this. We found it on the HBO streaming library. Certainly it's something that if you happen to stumble onto it in the middle. I just love the chemistry between the ensemble. Like, you got a large functional ensemble here. They're all having a lot of fun at work. It's not so bad it's good. It's genuinely great without being good.
Good way of putting that. That is definitely the pull quote of the episode there. All right, well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to wrap this up. Be sure to catch up with us on various measures of social media. We're over on Twitter at Nighthawks Pod. We're on Facebook at the Nighthawks Podcast. You can also find us through your preferred podcast or streaming app. We're on several of those. You can find us definitely with Stitcher and iTunes. And if you guys would just do us a kindness, do us a favor, and leave us a review, leave us a rating, and subscribe on your podcast aggregate of choice, it would do us a huge favor. And always be sure to let your friends know if you're enjoying what you're hearing here, and let us know. We're good people. We like feedback and to be reached out to. So feel free to reach out.
Reach out and rate someone. Don't touch. We're delicate.
So anyways, folks, that's going to wrap things up for this Gone in 60 Seconds edition of the Nighthawks podcast. We're going to see you off. Have a safe and pleasant evening. Take care out there. And we're going to sign off because it's almost morning.
Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong?
Can we have pie now?
We can have pie.
Can it be time for go to pie?